Vengono.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 2nd, 2016. First item on the agenda is a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 4003.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4003 comes to you from Speaker Kotek. There is no revenue impact on this, minimal fiscal. This is ready to move pace should you choose to do so. As you recall, in the 2015 session, you passed House Bill 2002, which established the Law Enforcement Profiling Work Group. The measure also prohibited profiling by law enforcement and charged the work group with proposing a process to identify any patterns or practices of profiling and to identify methods for remedying this situation. They did give us a report on December 1st, 2015. This measure, House Bill 4003, would extend the work group through July 1, 2017.
Okay, thank you. Call Attorney General Rosenblum and Aaron Knott, please. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, it's great to be back. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Oregon, and I come before you in support of House Bill 4003, which extends the existence of the Law Enforcement Profiling Work Group until December 1st of 2016. Profiling by law enforcement is a longstanding and deeply troubling national problem that occurs when law enforcement targets people of color and other specific populations for criminal investigations solely because of their race, ethnicity, national origin, or other characteristics which have no relation to their criminality. When it occurs, profiling is profoundly destructive. Profiling alienates the community from law enforcement, causes the rule of law to lose credibility and trust, and discourages community members from relying on law enforcement for help. This, in turn, makes the investigation of criminal activity more difficult by making witnesses more reluctant to participate and generally makes policing harder, less rewarding, and less credible in the eyes of the public. National statistics on profiling suggest that black drivers are more than twice as likely than white drivers to be arrested during a traffic stop, and that white drivers are far more likely to be let off with a warning. Additionally, people of color are more likely to be searched during a traffic stop. During the 2015 session, Oregon became the 31st state to explicitly ban profiling by law enforcement with the passage of House Bill 2002. This bill put into place a definition of profiling unique to Oregon, which prohibits a law enforcement officer from targeting an individual for suspicion of a violation of law based solely on the individual's age, race, ethnicity, color, national origin, language, gender identity, sexual orientation, political affiliation, religion, homelessness, or disability. The bill also required all complaints alleging profiling by law enforcement to be shared with the Law Enforcement Contacts, Policy, and Data Review Committee, also known as LECC. Finally, House Bill 2002 formed the Law Enforcement Profiling Work Group. This group, appointed in equal measure by the Governor, President of the Senate, and Speaker of the House, was asked to do three things. First, to propose a process to identify any patterns or practices of profiling. Second, to identify methods to address and correct patterns or practices of profiling. Finally, to prepare a report identifying any statutory changes needed, including recommendations for legislation, to the interim committees of the judiciary no later than December 1st, 2015. By statute, this work group was to be chaired by the Attorney General and staffed by the Department of Justice. This group was appointed on August 21st of last year and met for the first time on September 14th. Between September 14th and December 1st, this nine-person work group met in varying combinations a total of 13 times, including two opportunities for public comment held in Portland and Medford. The members of this work group worked very hard and very quickly to craft meaningful policy recommendations, which we outlined in a report filed to the legislature and submitted on December 1st. I come before you today to describe the work we have already done and to ask for your support in allowing us to continue this important work for another year. Before I go any further, I would like to take a moment and thank the members of this work group. When I first learned that this group would be given only 4 months to generate a report, I was frankly a bit skeptical. The question of profiling is extremely complex, and the solutions never easy nor obvious. To the last member, this group came together quickly, spoke openly, and worked always to find solutions to differences of opinion. I want to ask for your indulgence just for a moment and allow me to extend my thanks to these 9 individuals by name, some of whom are here today. District Attorney John Haroldson, Casey Jama, who I know is here, Anil Karya, Sheriff Jason Myers, Kimberly McCullough, Brooke Reinhart, Constantine Sevier, Chief John Teague, who I believe is here also, and Irma Valdez. Each of them found time within universally busy schedules to give this issue the very serious attention it deserves, and they have my deepest thanks. I also wish to thank my staff, Aaron Knott and Arias Johnson, and Michael Slauson, who helped to staff this group and prepare the report that was completed timely and that you should all have a copy of. This report is much too long to cover completely, so I will call your attention to page 9, which covers the 7 broad recommendations issued by this group. I want to discuss each of these with you very briefly. Again, I'm mindful of this committee's time and will move quickly, so please ask any questions necessary to clarify any point which is not clear. Upon convening, the work group divided into 3 subcommittees, which we felt best captured the scope of the work to be done. The first of these, the Law Enforcement Response Subgroup, focused on the steps that law enforcement could take on their own initiative, improvements in training, complaint responsiveness, and other measures to take on the problem of profiling within their own management, culture, and structure. The second was the subgroup on data, identified that we cannot, in fact, identify patterns or practices of profiling without a data set from which these conclusions can be drawn. So we called that the data group. This subgroup worked to evaluate already existing libraries of data in Oregon, as well as examining the steps taken by other states to track data. The final subgroup on law enforcement responsibility and transparency asked the broad question of, so what? Once a pattern or practice of profiling is determined to exist, what should be done about it? All 3 subgroups returned conclusions which form the backbone of the 7 recommendations contained in the report, which I will now briefly outline. First, training must be improved. House Bill 2002 created a complex and expansive new definition of profiling. This definition won't be worth much if our law enforcement personnel are not adequately trained to understand and effectively use it. We've also heard from community members that this training must be evaluated through the lens of cultural competency, and community stakeholders must be given the opportunity for participation and feedback. DPSST already provides significant training in this area, and over the coming months, I anticipate that members of this task force will audit and attend these trainings, as well as evaluating comparable trainings given by other states and jurisdictions. Second, the law enforcement response to complaints of profiling must improve. When a person makes a complaint of profiling to a law enforcement agency, they should be entitled to know what happened to resolve it. The task force heard that while many law enforcement agencies are extremely responsive to complaints, in some cases, a complaining person can expect a call, in fact, from the elected chief or sheriff themselves explaining the outcome. But there's no standard practice across Oregon, and some complaints simply disappear after they're made, leaving the citizen who made the complaint completely in the dark. This is unacceptable. This task force will work to create and propose legislation that requires a response to be made within a reasonable time. Third, as written, House Bill 2002 requires that any profiling complaints made to a law enforcement agency be shared with the LECC, but nothing requires law enforcement to share with the LECC how the complaint was resolved. So a similar issue, just as a complaining person should be entitled to a statement letting him or her know how the complaint was resolved, the LECC should be able to expect a statement of resolution, which will allow them to track in a broader way how long complaints are taking to be resolved and the rate at which these complaints are found to be held substantiated or unsubstantiated. A policy which simply finds 100% of all complaints unsubstantiated is not a functional policy. Fourth, the chiefs of police, sheriffs, district attorneys, LECC, and attorney general have begun the task of working together to craft model policies to implement the requirements of House Bill 2002, including the timing and form by which complaint information should be shared with the LECC, and best practices around the receipt and investigation of profiling complaints. This work will continue throughout the year, and the existence of the work group provides us with a unique opportunity to bring a wide array of stakeholders into that conversation. Fifth, we need to develop an accountability structure in response to allegations of profiling. This is the so what piece that I mentioned earlier. If data suggests the real possibility of a pattern or practice of profiling by law enforcement, the response must be meaningful. At the same time, no state-driven accountability system should displace the crucial internal investigations, functions, and autonomy of local law enforcement. Balance is crucial. In working toward an accountability structure suitable for Oregon, our work group looked to the system used by the Federal Department of Justice as a possible loose model for state legislation. Under this model, if the Civil Rights Division of the Oregon Department of Justice sees evidence of a pattern or practice of profiling, they investigate the matter and then, if necessary, enter into a collaborative discussion with the law enforcement body in order to provide technical guidance similar in nature to that provided by the U.S. Department of Justice. If these measures fail, the Oregon Department of Justice would publish the existence of the suspected pattern or practice of profiling, as well as any guidance provided to the legislature, the governor, the city or county in which the law enforcement body resides, and the United States Department of Justice. Six, most states which have taken on the issue of profiling have required the collection of data relating to traffic stops. Without clear data regarding who is being stopped by law enforcement, who is being cited, who's being subjected to a search, and who is being let off with a warning, it's hard to imagine that our ability to identify patterns or practices of profiling could ever be fully informed. The work group has conducted a national review of programs implemented by other states, and if given the opportunity to continue our work, anticipates modeling these programs for possible implementations in Oregon. I want to note that I and the work group are aware of the very serious shortfalls in public safety funding levels in multiple Oregon counties and the need to avoid an unfunded mandate or one-size-fits-all approach. There is a material cost, both in terms of officer time used and in terms of the cost of the collection, storing, and analysis of any data that's collected. That being said, we are only as smart as our data, and our existing data is simply not good enough. Finally, we should follow the lead of other states in requiring the publication of an annual report available to the public, which will guide policymakers, law enforcement, and the public with the tools they need to inform their decisions around law enforcement policy. The LECC has issued these reports in the past whenever possible, but inconsistent funding and inconsistent data have been consistent challenges. While I intend to fully investigate and develop each of these recommendations over the coming year, I want to emphasize that this should not be taken as an exhaustive list. This work group was provided with only 4 months to develop our recommendations, and concessions were made because we simply didn't have time to consider everything possible. But I believe the recommendations already before you are the solid foundation for a meaningful and workable policy package in the 2017 session. Sitting with me is my legislative director, Aaron Knott, who worked as the primary technical drafter and researcher of this report, along with my civil rights director, Arias Johnson, and as I mentioned, the director of our criminal justice division, Michael Slauson. I also want to thank Representative Lou Fredericks for his support throughout this process. I want to also note that I brought with me 200 postcards received from many people in this room supporting the work of the profiling task force that were provided to me at one of our public hearings in Portland. I keep these in my office because I want to be reminded every day of the importance of our public hearings and of the many people around the state who came and spoke to our very poignantly to our task force. So at this time, I will conclude and ask if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing. I'm Lou Frederick, State Representative from District 43. There is a basic issue for me in dealing with this particular concern about profiling, and it's credibility. The whole idea is to be able to make sure that we have the support of the communities that are involved in any sort of law enforcement effort. The profiling work group managed to hold some of the most impressive and heart-wrenching hearings that you can possibly attend, in the hearing that I went to in Portland, there was no repeat message. Everyone who got up there spoke about their concerns and the various approaches that they've had to deal with. Folks struggling who were profiled on the MAX train, or walking down the street, or in other places around the city and around the state. It was a very incredible list of issues. But what also happened is, after that, they also came and talked with me about the fact that they were so happy that someone was finally listening to them, and that this was not something that they were just experiencing themselves. You've heard me talk about my own experiences. It's difficult to explain them sometimes, because folks do not have that same experience. I've had the experience of being stopped and profiled on a regular basis. My last one was in October of this last year, and I just had to deal with that, realizing that once a year I get stopped. So the fact that we had this kind of a workshop, a work group, and that it was actually functioning is adding credibility to our whole system. And I hope that you will, in fact, extend this particular work group deadline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. And for better or for worse, I was the primary drafter and technical researcher in putting this report together. And I'm here to answer any questions you may have about the contents of the report or the process by which we put it together.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. As I have gone through the report, maybe I missed it, and maybe this is a subsequent conversation or a future conversation, but is there data of investigations and how many allegations of profiling are substantiated and how many are not? Was that part of the discussion in this?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I think the first remark I would make is that we lacked some definitions. As I said, we became the 31st state to put a definition in statute which specifically prohibited profiling. Even prior to that, the LECC has been involved in a process of trying to actually gather that data for the first time. That's one of the big things House Bill 2002 does, is it requires all of those complaints to go to one centralized repository for the first time. I think in the absence of that centralized repository, we don't have excellent data about the number of complaints that are going in. We did hear presentations and have conversations with the city of Portland, the city of Corvallis, the city of Eugene. They all came in and presented, usually via their law enforcement. Portland came in versus a person who's assigned specifically looking at these kinds of cases. So we have isolated data.
Well, Mr. Yeah, Chair, please. Thank you. That helps. I'd like to see that piece. I know as we've gone through this process, and it's a very serious process, I think it's important to see how widespread pockets of areas that the problem is more significant than others, or where it doesn't exist. And sometimes life is perception. I had a complaint filed on me one time that I was really mad and drove into a lot crazy and was upset and da-da-da. Never talked to the person. I have no idea what was going on. That was what this person, and it wasn't about profiling, that's what this person perceived. And there was really no way to talk about that when I don't know when I was mad and I don't know, you know, when this occurred kind of thing. So I think it's important to make sure we're substantiating. I know that And you mentioned Corvallis in here as one of five or six cities. And I used to work in the Sheriff's Department over in that area, and they have been very good about data collection for a lot of years. And I know as a cop, sometimes the encounters I had with a person was because a citizen called in and said, for X reason, you need to encounter this person. So I'd like to look at that data because it's not a police officer saying, I'm targeting this person. It's a police officer rightfully responding to an allegation of whatever, something minor, something substantial. Can you talk about some of the data maybe Corvallis has on that?
Absolutely. Chair Barker, Representative Springer. So I don't know if any of you in here have Corvallis in your district or Benton County generally. They're way out in front on this stuff. Representative Springer is correct. And so the attempts that they've made on their own initiative to collect data have been fairly sophisticated. What I think the representative is making reference to is an audit of their own data they did, and I'm going to engage in a bit of paraphrasing here, but they realized that Hispanic individuals were being stopped at a rate that exceeded the representation in the population. And they went back and really dug into that data to try to figure out why that was happening. One of the variables they controlled for was officer-initiated behavior, like I'm an officer, somebody doesn't signal, I elect to pull them over, versus non-officer-initiated or dispatch behavior. I received a call, or rather 911 or suspicious persons receives a call, and they direct me as an officer to look for a suspect. When I encounter that suspect, I pull them over, but that decision was in a sense made for me. What they found with that inquiry is once they controlled for officer initiated versus non-officer initiated, the conclusion they ultimately drawn is that Hispanic individuals in the city of Corvallis were the subject of more suspicious persons calls from civilians. And I think that makes an excellent point that was made in a number of contexts to our task force about implicit bias, that it's something that we all carry around. You know, our instincts on making these judgments, who you do or do not call in as suspicious, can inform the ultimate decision by law enforcement. But that tension against what I'll call subjective and objective data is something that we tried to consider. There are points of data you can look at that are objective, things like how long was a person stopped for? Were they asked for a search? Were they let off with a warning? And no matter what the officer says, you know, I thought X or I thought Y, over enough transactions you can start to see trends. You can see Hispanic individuals in this county are being detained longer, or they're being asked to be searched more often, or they're being asked or let off with a warning less often, which is an attempt to make that objective data, which is not driven entirely by sort of the officer's subjective sense of, am I interacting with a person of this race, of this ethnicity, of this political party, what have you.
Thank you. And may I follow up?
Yes, you can.
And let me be really clear. I don't care if it's a citizen calling it in or a police officer, whoever. I'm not justifying the behavior, but I'm saying if we're going to do a report like this, it behooves us to look at how the information is initially gathered and where the information source comes from. There would be a very legitimate complaint against a police officer who simply said, no, I won't take that call. We don't want that either. So I think that is something that needs to have some clear focus here, and that's where I think gathering data on complaints filed, and complaints have to be filed. I've had to file complaints on different things in my life. We have to take that responsibility and file the complaint, and then that allows that investigative process to occur. And I think that's very important. And frankly, as I read through the report, and it's a good report, and I'm glad you're continuing the work, and you need to continue the work, because undoubtedly profiling occurs some places, but not everywhere, or not all the time. And I think it's important as we look at this that we're not just basing everything or looking through everything through the lens of this is occurring. Let's find it. That colors our impressions a little bit more than let's get the data and sort this through and then target very specifically what we're looking at, and what that will help us with is the training of the officers, because clearly there's a training element here that needs to be covered. There was no question there, was there?
Thank you very much, ma'am. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Called Chief Teague and Michael Savaggio.
Thank you.
Yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Committee members, my name is John Teague. I'm the Chief of Police, City of Kaiser. I'm here speaking on my behalf and that of Jason Myers. Both of us are on the Law Enforcement Profiling Task Force. I'm also speaking for our respective associations, the Chiefs of Police Association and the Sheriff's Association. We're both thankful for being able to serve on the task force. I do want to thank the legislature for moving on this in a way that is more forceful than they might even be aware, and that goes back to the 2013 legislative session. We introduced Senate Bill 481, which proposed establishing the Center for Policing Excellence. That language was rolled into House Bill 3194. And I want to tell you, what used to be traditional policing, which frankly I'll just describe as taking the law and imposing it upon people and to heck with the consequences, those days are long gone. We're on the downhill side of changing the culture in law enforcement, but they're not complete yet. Clearly we're not complete yet. But I do say that we are significantly and obviously to ourselves and interested in making sure that we bring justice to our communities, and not only justice, but the feelings of justice. And by that, what I mean is not only dealing with people justly, but ensuring that individuals and communities feel like they have justice. And clearly, we're not to that point yet. And we need to make motions such that they do feel that way. And House Bill 2002 and this Law Enforcement Profiling Task Force takes us there. We appreciate being part of the conversation. We encourage you, the legislature, to pass House Bill 4003 to further our work up until 2017. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. The coalition is pleased to endorse House Bill 4003. We were very pleased to support the profiling bill last session, 2002. As the people that have come before me put more eloquently than I can, this is a very complex issue. It bears a lot of careful consideration, but it is a very valuable conversation to have. We are pleased to be involved in the process, and we urge you to support House Bill 4003 so that we can continue these conversations. And I'll take any questions.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to, anytime I get a chance, to give a shout out to my own chief, Chief Teague from hometown of Kaiser. Thank you, Chief Teague. And I appreciate all the work that everybody did on this, but I appreciate especially that a small town, I mean, we're not that small, but we're pretty small. Small town chief was a part of this. I think that's a big deal, so that it looks great to see a smaller town involved in something that generally most people would think is a big town issue. So it shows that it is a small town issue as well, and I want to thank you for being a part of that.
And I would mention that the group that Mr. Savaggio represents are the police unions, and so it's important to know that they're on board with this as well.
You might comment to that. Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Post. I appreciate that comment. I want to tell you that DPSST is interested in making sure that right policing hits every single corner of this state and every single person that lives in this state and visits this state. So thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you very much. Open a work session on House Bill 4003.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4003 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Langer moves House Bill 4003 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Representative Frederick, maybe?
Representative Frederick carry the bill. Open a hearing on House Bill 4073.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4073. It was brought to us today by Representative Greenlick. There is no revenue or fiscal impact. Oregon currently only allows marriages to be solemnized by a judicial officer, a county clerk, or religious organizations or congregations, or a clergy person of one of those organizations. There is no provision in Oregon for a secular organization to solemnize marriages. House Bill 4073 adds secular organizations or a celebrant or officiant of a secular organization to the list of persons or entities authorized to solemnize marriages. It also defines secular organizations, and it also provides conforming language for related Oregon statutes. There are no amendments, and it is ready to move today.
Representative
Greenlick, please. And Mr. Harvey. Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. And I'm glad to be here to present House Bill 4073. 4073 is a new version of a bill we had in the last in the full session. It passed out of the House and went to the Senate and died in the hospice of the Senate late in the session. The original situation is when a couple wants to get married, they go down and take out a marriage license. Then they get married. And then somebody has to solemnize their marriage to make it official. And right now there are three options for people who can solemnize a marriage: two secular and one sacred. A clergyman can solemnize the marriage, a judge can solemnize the marriage, or the county clerk can solemnize the marriage on the payment of a fee in the neighborhood of $125. That's the county clerk's fee. What this bill does is add one more option to the class of the folks that can solemnize that marriage. In the original version that came to the Rules Committee in the last session, it added three options. It added the officials of secular organizations. It added all prior and current state legislators, and added the couple itself. It seemed to me that in the do-it-yourself age, there's no reason why the couple couldn't solemnize their own marriage. Along the way, the couple themselves was whittled off the bill, and in the Senate and in the House discussion of it, there was clear nervousness about having legislators do this job. So the bill that comes to you today has only one additional option for solemnizing marriage. That's officials of secular organizations. Mr. Harvey will talk to you more specifically about what a secular organization is, but basically, if you think of an organization that serves a similar function to organized religion, where people come to seek community in a form that's different than the form of a church or a synagogue or a religious organization. These are organizations in our society that serve that function. Well, I would ask you to work the bill and to move it on for further action.
Thank you. Mr. Harvey?
Yes, thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Brian Harvey. I'm the director of the Secular Coalition for Oregon, which represents 16 nonprofits from communities across Oregon, including Corvallis, Eugene, Portland, Bend, Salem, Coos Bay, Grants Pass, Ashland, Klamath Falls, and McMinnville. And as Representative Greenlick just mentioned, currently the only non-governmental entities that can legally marry couples are religious congregations and their clergy. And while depending on which county one might find oneself in, the cost of a marriage license can differ, maybe it's $40 or $50 or $60, Regardless of where you are in Oregon, there is an additional even $105 solemnization fee imposed by either a judge or a clerk. If it's a government official that solemnizes your marriage, you're paying that extra $105. So the current law presents a serious obstacle to non-religious Oregonians and those not affiliated with any official denomination who are in many respects denied the opportunity to be married by the person of their choice, by someone who shares their philosophy on love and marriage, who can marry them at their wedding. And several of the organizations in our coalition do train and certify officiants who are already actively officiating at weddings and funerals and the like. And for members of that community, that's the appropriate person to be doing that. However, at weddings, their officiating doesn't carry the legal force that a priest or a pastor or a rabbi would. And just before I forget, Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU of Oregon was unable to make it to testify today. And she has expressed her support for the bill and authorized me to indicate that the ACL believes this statute is, as her testimony, her written testimony indicates, in not in the spirit of Oregon's state constitution. So, you know, for the people that I represent, they aren't able to get married at their wedding in the same way. They are charged an extra $105 if they are to take that extra step of going to a county clerk or a county judge. And I think when we look at this bill, it doesn't take any rights away from anyone. And there's no ill intent in the bill at all. And I have a religious background. I was raised in the Catholic faith. I went through every year of Sunday school, what Catholics tend to call CCD. I was an altar boy. I was confirmed as a Catholic. I had a very positive experience in the church. But my views have changed, and the community that I'm a part of now represents the current state of my worldview. And I have the utmost respect for people of faith, which represents, you know, many of my friends and family. And I guess my hope is that we can view this bill as an expansion of equality instead of, anything else that might be slightly less positive. So, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out we submitted an Oregonian editorial supporting the version of the bill in the last session. We thought you might find it interesting.
Could I speak to that just briefly then? So the Oregonians, could I?
Yes.
The Oregonian, I should have already. I've scattered notes, so I apologize. The Oregonians editorial board did endorse the bill. Their reasoning being, when we look at instances like certain judges and clerks in recent news coverage who have received blowback from not being willing or interested to participate in marriages whose nature they disagreed with, the editorial board's argument was, well, you know, Oregon, you don't have any non-governmental secular option. So if people aren't going to get married by a rabbi, a priest, a pastor, whatever the title may be, then we are placing the entirety of the rest of the burden on judges and on clerks. And I think that this is a little bit of a release valve there. And, you know, again, allows people to be married by someone who does share their worldview. So, thank you, Chair.
Any questions, Representative Post?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so what I'm hearing is a big deal would be to save $105, because you have to pay another $105 if you don't want it solemnized by a pastor, priest, rabbi. So if that's an issue, I have something that's on OLIS that you can all look at. I think I have hard copies if you need it. Guess what? It's $30 and you can do a wedding in Oregon. Conan O'Brien, Kathy Griffin, Sir Ian McKellen, Joan Rivers, Brian Cranston, Johnny Carson are all able to, well, they're dead, some of them, but the ones that are alive can do weddings. It's $30, you get a license, you can do a wedding, and it's represented by every denomination, non-denomination, including the atheists of America, all approve of this. So $30, so I just saved you $70, $75.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that, please?
Sure, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Post, that's not why I brought this bill. I think there is an issue, but I brought this bill because it seems to me people have a right to be married in an environment that fits their personal needs, their beliefs, and their views. And the secular organization Mr. Harvey represents is that kind of, are those kind of organizations for a significant segment of our population. Oregon is both a fairly religious community and a fairly secular community at the same time. Relatively high level of religiosity, relatively high level of secular opinions. But the purpose of this bill is to serve the citizens of Oregon who find themselves more comfortable in an environment that that allows them to get married in. Now, you and I both know that a person can go on. I was at a wedding not very long ago where the person that officiated was the cousin of the bride and went on the internet and essentially bought a religious certification for $25. That's okay, but it seems in my mind to diminish the whole, if you will, the whole sanctity of marriage. Having somebody officiating your marriage, other than going to a county clerk, that comes from an organization that celebrates their community in the way these organizations do, is simply an appropriate move, and it isn't really about the money at all.
And I understand that. I just heard that 105 and wrote it down just now. My thinking originally was what you talked about. I have a friend who is very much what you're talking about. He didn't want a religious wedding for his daughter, so he emailed me, and he's the one to inform me about this website. And he said, guess what? I got the license, and I did the wedding. So he was in the situation he wanted. He was in the building he wanted. He was in everything he wanted. It cost him $30. So it kind of takes – I don't see that we need a state law to fix something that's already there.
Well, that's a form of a pseudo-religious experience. And I think it's much more honest to have a secular experience that's a straightforward experience than that. And that's, I think, the function of this bill, is to serve our citizens.
Chair Barker.
The list of names you read off, I mean, people did that kind of like as a joke to show they could get become a minister, a credential minister. That's been running. They've had that for years. I mean, I remember we had a case in Portland where the fire department wouldn't allow the police to have Christmas lights on the Christmas tree. So policemen spend more than the $30 because he became a PhD minister, doctor of divinity, and he blessed the tree so the lights could stay on. And but it was all kind of, you know, in good humor. And this is, you know, more of a spirit of people. I believe the intention is if people want to be with their community, they can do it in their community. Anything further? Any further questions?
I do.
Okay. Representative Springer.
So when it talks about page one, a celebrant or officiant of any secular organization described in paragraph B of this subsection. So as I go through that, maybe one of you can tell me in just real simple terms, not who, what organizations can qualify and how do they qualify? Or is that a criteria?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, So we based the current wording of this bill on case law. And one of the organizations in our coalition, the Center for Inquiry, who has a Portland branch, but as a national nonprofit also has an Indiana branch, did, after some time and legislative failures, end up bringing suit against the state of Indiana regarding a similarly what we would view as discriminatory solemnization statute. And in that case, they lost at the district level, but ended up winning in a unanimous decision at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And the case law that the United States Supreme Court precedent that was cited by the Seventh Circuit is exactly the wording that we use to define secular organizations in this bill. And that is essentially an organization that occupies a parallel place in the lives of their members as a church would. And just as the state is hesitant to define what constitutes religion and what's outside the bounds therein, in this case, we are just asking for the same scope that that an organization whose for whose members this occupies a parallel place in their life as a church would for a religious organization, if that organization agrees and is willing to solemnize marriages, that meets the definition. And we think that in this case, it's you know, both broad but relatively concise, and also subscribes to current case law. So.
So about any organization? I don't understand yet. I mean, is there a 501c3 status? Are there any elements like that or a group of like-minded people say we're an organization?
Yeah.
Five like-minded people say we're now an organization, which they have the right to do.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, what's interesting about Oregon actually is that states that have similar solemnization statutes are more commonly do require that a religious organization has a definition. That is, that it's a 501c3, that its exemption is of a religious nature, that it is filed and recognized by the Secretary of State. And in Oregon, that's just simply not the case. There is no definition for what constitutes a religious organization that would qualify under the law. There's no directory kept of which organizations do qualify, nor of the individuals certified by those organizations to solemnize marriages. So the current law, as it applies to religious organizations, is sufficiently vague that there's no additional vagueness being added by the current definition for a secular organization.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 4073.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4073 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Leininger moves House Bill 4073 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion. Mm-hmm. Any call? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye. Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Leininger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Greenlick, would you carry the floor?
Be delighted.
I'm going to briefly reopen House Bill 4003, Mr. Gamma. Didn't realize you wanted to testify or didn't get signed up. So and we do have a time issue, so appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I thought I was a special, but here I am. You have my long testimony, so I won't be really...
And I'm sorry, could you say your name for the record?
Sure. For the record, my name is Casey Chama. I am the executive director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We are the lead organization who is pushing this issue for end profiling. But I am also here today as a member of the Law Enforcement Profile Working Group. You do have my long testimony, but I think in essence of time, I'm going to focus a little bit about area that I do believe that we need to have more deeper discussion on this issue as we need expansion of the time. In addition to what I want to emphasize that while we will continue to develop recommendations on the policies area that we have already explored, like data collection, for example, there are some important issues that we simply did not have time to address. So I would like this committee to understand that it's more than just tinkering with our current recommendations. We also would like to explore issues areas such as how to identify stop profiling that want to be identified in stop data, for example, housing status or religion. We also like to how do we collect the data on pedestrian stops. We also like to think about addressing whether or not to allow for evidence suppression in criminal trial when person can show they were profiled. We also like to potentially to discuss as a work group consent search reforms and other procedural justice issues. So these are the area that if we had time, that we could have actually potentially go into a deeper discussion, but we did not address those issues. Okay. So with that said, I would like to ask you to extend this work group's timeline so we can dive into those meaningful discussions in the future. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you. And, of course, you saw we did move the bill, so we are going to
thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is House Bill 4127.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is House Bill 4127, and it is brought to us today by Representative Vega Peterson. There is no revenue or fiscal impact. In Oregon and nationwide, couples of the same sex are entitled to marriage to the same extent as couples of the opposite sex. House Bill 4127 recognizes this right by establishing that it is the state policy that all privileges, immunities, rights, benefits, or responsibilities governed by law given to a person because of marriage to a person of the opposite sex applies with equal force to a person who is married or was married to a person of the same sex. It also updates statutes to contain gender-neutral language. There are no amendments.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative in House District 47, which is in East Portland. Colleagues, today I'm very happy to bring you House Bill 4127. This bill is really a simple bill that updates language in Oregon statutes in light of the Supreme Court's June 26, 2015 ruling on same-sex marriage. This bill finishes the job that we began in the 2015 legislative session with House Bill 2478. It inserts into applicable statute neutral language with respect to individuals in a marital partnership. This bill, House Bill 4127, accomplishes three things. First of all, it amends the ORS that was referred to before that deals with marital relationships and court proceedings. It also amends the language that deals with presumptions and updates that to, instead of saying man and woman, individuals and husband and wife to legally married to each other. And finally, in Section 3 of the bill, which is really a catch-all bill, it ensures that the policy of the state is that all statutes in Oregon apply equally to couples, regardless if they are same-sex couples or different sex. And I just wanted to, you know, finish by saying that there is a letter of support from the ACLU that you'll find on OLIS. And I know that we have somebody here from Basic Rights Oregon that will also be testifying today. So this bill is going to have very real positive effects for couples and families in Oregon. It ensures that our statutes are specific, clear, and in line with federal law. I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I urge your support of this bill.
Nancy Hawk, please.
Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Hawk, and I'm the co-executive director of Basic Rights Oregon, our state's leading advocacy group, working to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Oregonians experience equality. So almost 2 years ago, on May 19, 2014, U.S. District Court Judge Michael McShane ruled that gay and lesbian couples in Oregon have the same right and the freedom to marry. Since that momentous day, same-sex couples who were previously denied the ability to marry the person they love have now done so. So much joy, so much love, and so many happy families. Then, right towards the end of our 2015 session, and after we passed the first portion of this bill on June 26th, the Supreme Court ruled that the freedom to marry is the law of the land. In fact, with the federal court ending the ban on committing LGBTQ couples marrying here, Oregon had already joined 36 other states, plus the District of Columbia, that recognizes marriage between two loving individuals, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, before the Supreme Court ruling. And as has been true for other states that have extended the freedom to marry to same-sex couples, Oregon now must update and modernize its marriage statutes to reflect this reality. We started this process with HB 2478 in 2015, and now, as we agreed, we are returning with the final updates to the marriage statutes. Every state has or will go through a process to update and modernize its marriage statutes to reflect the constitutional ruling. As many other states before us have recognized and contended with, a discrepancy now exists between the recognized law of our land, the freedom to marry, and outdated, unenforceable language in our state statutes. Statutes that still define marriage as between a husband and a wife. House Bill 4127 updates and modernizes Oregon's marriage statutes to fix this discrepancy and to reflect that we now recognize the freedom to marry for all loving, committed couples, including same-sex couples. In short, HB 4127 would amend Oregon state statutes referring to marriage to be two spouses to ensure all couples who are married in Oregon are covered under the law. Specific updates contained in HB 2478 include making statutes more gender neutral to reflect that both same-sex and opposite-sex couples can marry. I won't repeat the details that Representative Vega Peterson shared with the committee, but I just want to say that while it might sound dry, this bill actually has very real positive effects for LGBTQ families by ensuring that our statutes are specific and in line with the law. Thank you for bringing this forward, and I urge your support of 4127. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's very good question. Thank you. The committee's going to stand at ease for a few minutes. Bill 4127.
Do you want me to? Yeah. We already did. Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Leininger moves House Bill 4127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes. Representative
Spring,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We arrived at this point through the court. The judicial branch's decision on an issue, and I respect that. This language will be incongruent with the Constitution as it state Constitution as it stands today. Therefore, I'll be a no.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Fuchs.
No.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Chair Leininger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Vega Peterson, will you carry the bill first, please?
I will. Thank you.
We stand adjourned.